from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
That's President Donald Trump speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference on Friday, just hours before the White House barred some news outlets, including CNN and the New York Times, from attending an off-camera press briefing. We'll discuss that and all of the latest political news, including Saturday's election of former Labor Secretary Tom Perez as the new chair of the Democratic National Committee, and President Trump's just-announced plan to boost defense spending by about 9%. It's all coming up on Forum after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. It was another dizzying weekend for political news. President Donald Trump announced on Saturday that he would not attend the annual White House Correspondents Association dinner. And that same day, the Democratic National Committee elected a new chair, Tom Perez, a former Obama administration labor secretary and the party's first Latino leader. Perez defeated Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison in a highly contentious race over who would best take on the Trump administration. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump's agenda was enthusiastically embraced at last week's Conservative Political Action Conference and at the California GOP's annual conference this weekend. I want to take up these stories and more with a panel of political reporters, and let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. Here in studio, we have with us Scott Schaefer, senior editor for for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. And good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Michael.
And Joe Garofoli is also with us in studio, senior political writer for the San Francisco Garofoli. See what happens when you read things phonetically. And Joe, thanks for being here. Good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you, Michael.
We also have Shannon Pettypiece with us, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, and she joins us from the nation's capital. Shannon Pettypiece, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Let me begin with you because there were some announcements today. We're expecting a speech by President Trump tomorrow to Congress, and he's kind of outlined essentially what that might be in terms of the budget. It means at least a lot more money for defense and for security at this point, but probably a lot less for domestic programs.
Yeah, he referred to this as a public safety budget. Big increase in spending for defense, about a 10% increase. That's around $54 billion. And to pay for that, it's going to mean cuts across the board among domestic agencies. The EPA, our reporting indicates, is expected to be a big cut, an area of cuts. We had some officials telling us just a couple days ago that EPA staff could shrink by two-thirds. State Department's also expected to get large cuts there, and foreign aid is another area that will likely be cut to pay for this increase in defense spending. And that defense spending also includes, we believe, increases to, sort of domestic security and law enforcement. The president kind of characterized it as, focus on keeping terrorists out of the country.
I'd like to follow that up with some more questions, Shannon. But first, since you mentioned the EPA, Scott Pruitt has been named pretty much head of the EPA. And he conducted state business, it turns out, in Oklahoma by using a private email server, denied that and sent a testimony. Is that going anywhere?
I don't know if someone, Republicans in Congress want to add that to the list of things to investigate. Obviously, there was much talk about Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server when she was at State Department. She was, of course, a presidential candidate. So, was it with a heightened sense of scrutiny around it? I really actually, though, feel like I haven't heard that much yet, at least on the Hill or in the White House about this private server with Scott Pruitt.
Well, let me go to things you have heard of. It's going to be a new travel ban rolled out. What can we expect? New executive order, meaning what?
So far we know it will be something coming very soon. We don't really know the specifics of it, but they have been working on it for longer than we expected. We kept being told for weeks now, any day now. And so now we're told it's imminent. It's going to be something released very soon. Previously, we had been told that it would be pretty similar to the travel ban that was currently in place, though it would you know, they really, really rush that one out, and that this one they would really sort of lock things in and you know, make it a little more solid legally and less of like a present to the ACLU with, you know, a lot of legal holes that could be poked in it. So they've been trying to make make it a lot more tighter legally. But I don't think the spirit or the idea is going to change. The administration seems very focused on this idea that there does need to be at least a temporary hold on travel from certain countries, predominantly Muslim countries, and that is necessary for national security until they can get their quote-unquote extreme vetting process in place.
Well, let's talk about that just for a moment, because with all this talk about cutbacks in a budget, there's about $19 billion a year right now being spent on immigration one way or another, and President Trump has said we're going to go ahead with the wall, and originally he said maybe $8 billion. Now the figure has gone up in many people's judgment to $27, $40 billion even has been a figure I've heard. And ICE agents are essentially acting as police and rounding up people to a much greater degree. I mean, we've seen some really dramatic changes, have we not?
Yeah, and when you talk about budget, I mean, that's a great question that, you know, hasn't been outlined today about paying for the wall, paying for ICE. I mean, and I will say today we just got a very brief outline, rough briefing reporters did on what this budget's going to look like. And it's still, you know, March, mid-March is when it will go to Congress. And then, you know, I'll have more answers on questions like, does it pay for the wall or what type of infrastructure spending is on there? But yeah, the priorities of the country, I think the president has been very clear about laying out, is focused on defense, rebuilding our military, and national security inside the country. So those are the things where funding is going to be shifting to, border patrol, getting out, immigrants, the bad dudes, as the president keeps calling them, who have a criminal record, who shouldn't be in this country, protecting our borders, broader national defense, protection against terrorism. That's where the White House would like to see the funding being shifted and away from areas like EPA is just a constant target, or foreign aid. There's this idea of this America first that was mentioned in the inauguration that's continuing to play out in the budget.
And again, Shannon Pettypiece with us from the nation's capital is White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Scott Schaefer is senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Well, over the weekend, we heard President Trump declare the press as the enemy of the people. As I said, I wish he would read Ibsen, but we won't go there. He's really delegitimizing essentially the Fourth Estate, is he not?
He is, and it's not new. He's been doing it really for several months now, but it does seem to be being stepped up, and we're seeing it being implemented also in the briefing room at the White House where certain media are being excluded. And he's also – it's part of a larger campaign, I think, to delegitimize anybody who disagrees with him. We saw it in the courts with the judge in Washington who put a stop to the travel ban and the Ninth Circuit.
So the intelligence services.
The intelligence services, which is, you know, causing all kinds of leaks and chaos within the intelligence community. The judge in San Diego, Judge Curiel, who was born in Indiana, but he called, you know, Mexican during the Trump University trial. And so I think it is a disturbing trend of seeing these institutions, whether it's the courts, the media, as you mentioned, the intelligence community, that have been pillars of our government and of our culture and society and of democracy, really, being undermined somewhat systematically in a campaign by the president.
Well, this morning we heard from former President Bush, and he had something to say about the Fourth Estate. Let's hear.
I consider the media to be indispensable to democracy. That we need an independent media to hold people like me to account.
What kind of effect is this going to have on
Nothing
President
like being
Trump?
Out of office for 9 years, you know?
Well, but I think he's talking about fake news all the time, and we didn't hear any of that from W. We hear kind of a defense of the media from W.
Well, and I think most, John McCain, same thing. I mean, there's always sort of a contentious relationship at the local level, state level, national level between the media and elected officials because, you know, the media tends to uncover and put a spotlight on things that politicians don't necessarily want highlighted. But serious politicians, I think, understand that that's a part of the process, and it's an important part, integral part of the process. And so you're hearing George W. Bush, and I think you'll hear others, John McCain, I mentioned, being critical of what the president is saying.
We're also hearing a lot about transgender rights from the media and from the Trump administration and from Betsy DeVos and so forth. Where do things stand now, in your judgment, Scott?
Well, the Justice Department under Jeff Sessions withdrew advice that the Obama administration had given to schools, saying that it was a violation of Title IX to deny transgender students the right to access to the restrooms of their choice. And, you know, you may remember as a candidate, Donald Trump said, you know, no big deal. He was critical of the law, the so-called bathroom law in North Carolina. You've seen him now actually walk that back. I think probably that's the influence of Mike Pence, the vice president, who has very strong feelings about this. But you do see this battle going on in the White House between the sort of Reince Priebus, more mainstream part of the party, and Steve Bannon, the more extreme.
Yeah, but they were standing together at the CPAC conference and saying we're on the same team, right?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, showbiz.
It is showbiz. Let me go to Joe here. Joe Garofoli again here with us in studio, senior political writer for The Chronicle. There's been talk in Congress about setting up a separate investigative body to look into Russia's influence on the last election and so forth. Where's this going?
Well, right now it's not going anywhere because, let's face it, the Republicans have a complete power there. Over the weekend, Daryl Issa repeated to us and to Scott and I and other folks at the California Republican Convention that he would like to see a special prosecutor. That's a little ways down the road. But it's significant having someone like Issa say it. He's a member of the Oversight Board. He has long called for transparency on both sides, particularly against the Obama administration. But we also heard from Devin Nunes, who's head of the House Intelligence Committee, and he's like, nothing to see here. We don't need one of these.
He compared it to McCarthy era, but then you had Daryl Issa kind of talking the other way, didn't you?
Exactly. And he said, well, I don't agree with that. And one reason why is because Nunes was on Trump's transition team, and he's been a sort of a friend of the administration. And I think there's going to be increasing calls for him there'll be more of a spotlight on him to examine those ties.
And let's not forget, Issa, of course, barely survived a near-death experience in November.
He won by
1,600 votes.
Yeah, 1,200 votes.
He's the most endangered Republican in Congress in California, I'd say for sure.
Yeah,
but you do have other, McCain, you mentioned before, there are others who seem to feel that this is the way that things should go. I mean, toward a private investigation.
Yeah, or McCain,
transparent, open,
or a commission, an independent commission of some kind. I mean, I think the question is, and, you know, how serious, how are they really going to follow all the leads to wherever they may go in the Trump campaign when they do this investigation? I mean, Richard Burr, the senator from North Carolina, is, you know, very serious about this. But there is a question of just how far will they go? And I think John McCain said he's hopeful, but not, it's more hope than reality. Well, I mean, he sort of indicated, you know, it's probably not going to be a robust investigation like they did, for example, on Benghazi ad nauseum.
Right. And they have to branch out beside the McCain and Lindsey Graham, because those two are always at the front of the line. They don't like Trump. And let's face it, they don't like Trump. So once it broadens beyond that, then we'll have something here.
Yeah, but it would seem from what happened over the weekend that the party does like Trump now. The GOP is more behind him solidly, although he's moving very zealously, it would seem. I mean, I'm saying this in a nonpartisan way, to try to fulfill a lot of what he claimed were campaign promises, and he's got to get the Congress behind him.
Oh, and that's why Republicans love him. The base loves him. You see all these polls out where he said, where it says his approval rating is the lowest ever. But if you look at what Republicans think of him, so far they more like Trump now than liked Reagan at a similar point, or either of the Bushes at this similar point of their presidency. So
for California, because this is still the part, as Scott wrote in his recent piece, this is still the party of Ronald Reagan in California, right?
Well, Joe and I were at the Republican State Party headquarters for a little party on, I think it was Friday night or Saturday night. It's Friday night. And it's Reagan memorabilia everywhere.
Oh,
I mean, there was a mention of Schwarzenegger. There was a picture.
One picture of Schwarzenegger,
a couple little Trump things, but
Was it a bodybuilding picture?
No, it was like his official portrait,
he had his clothes
I think.
On.
Yes, clothes on. So it really, I mean, and I think that's a problem for the party. You know, they need to move. I mean, Reagan's been out of the White House for 28 years. You know, they really need to move on. And I think there is this kind of schism within the party. I mean, a year ago, the state party held a convention in Burlingame, and there was the big Stop Trump movement. The party was very divided and really almost desperate in some quarters to try to stop Trump. And now they're sort of having to, you know, make lemonade.
Well, they're pretty much behind Brulte, though, again, right? He's in for another term, and he's the leader.
Absolutely. But it's kind of a love the one you're with. They love the fact that Trump is a Republican president. But you know, and publicly they'll say that, but privately, they, you know, you start talking to folks and they're like, well,
some eye rolling.
I don't like the tweeting. I don't like all the off message tangents. I don't like, you know, even not mentioning Jews when you have a Holocaust remembrance statement. There's an uncomfortableness. I would say that the support for Trump here is among Republicans is broad and shallow.
Tentatively
for now. Yes.
What do you see up on the Hill, Shannon? Shannon Pettypiece, let's bring you back.
Yeah. So I'm going to be. I am interested in whether the tone and the attitudes change at all now that members of Congress are getting back from their districts, where there were these raucous town halls over the past week when they were on recess. I mean, I'm curious if that's going to have any impact and how they're going to gauge that and what, you know, because they're going to have to make a decision, as you guys are, you know, we're saying, you know, in the next, you know, really 6 months or so, is this a president who is the most popular figure in the Republican Party who I should hang, my, you know, attach my wagon to for my reelection in 2018? Or is this president toxic? What is the sentiment out there? How am I going to navigate that? I mean, some will have sophisticated polling they can do to sort of gauge the sentiment. But, you know, Republicans in smaller districts, you know, aren't going to be able to do that polling. They're going to be influenced, I think, by these things like these big town hall meetings, if those continue, calls that they get, you know, to their offices to gauge the public sentiment that, you know, should they be with or against this president, or maybe not against, but, you know, not backing wholeheartedly. And if they and you know, if it does come down, you know, in the Senate, you know, the Republicans control it by 3 votes with the Mike Pence tiebreaker, you know, can the Republicans stay locked arm in arm together to get through this ambitious agenda the president has? And I'm not so sure. So that's what I'm watching very carefully. I wish I knew the answers. I mean, we'll probably really only know when some of this ambitious legislation is actually put to the test.
Well, we saw a big town hall meeting with McClintock here in California, Scott.
And to his credit, he did 2 of them, actually. You know, I was struck at the convention this weekend up in Sacramento just how, I don't know, rattled might be too strong a word, but there was a lot of focus among the Republicans up there on all this Democratic activism. Jean Fuller, the Senate Minority Leader up in Sacramento, urging the grassroots worker bees up there to go to these town hall meetings. I think that there is a sense that they believe that these are all organized protests by labor unions. I'm not sure how true that is, but they're clearly worried. And I think that they, at the very least, it's bad optics for the members of Congress if those who are not holding these town hall meetings are doing them by telephone in a way that kind of shields them. Dianne Feinstein, for that matter. And we can talk about this. You know, the Democrats held an empty chair meeting over the weekend without Dianne Feinstein because, you know, she hasn't had any district meetings. So there is definitely a very acute level of Democratic activism right now that is, you know, rattling the Republicans, but also, you know, could be a risk for some Democrats who aren't quite with that program.
And Joe, if they're going to repeal Affordable Care Act, like Trump and his minions keep saying, the reality is that there are a lot of people who are going to be hurt by it, and what's going to come in its place? I mean, we haven't heard anything from the GOP about what they're going to replace it with.
Exactly. I was at one of the McClintock ones in Mariposa, population 2,700. There were 900 people at the town hall. And he has a very big district, and they were coming from all over the place. And that's the question people had. There was fear and anxiety. What comes next? People, you're talking about your health care.
Of course, Trump was speaking this morning about putting it back on the states. I mean, that was what he was intimating, it seemed to me.
Isn't a coherent plan yet. I mean, talking to people over the weekend, they haven't decided on one. It's still in the lab right now.
And I think the Democrats are going to have to decide, and maybe they already decided not to work with Republicans, especially in the House. Do they? Because the Republicans are going to have a real hard time agreeing on what to replace Obamacare with. And, you know, will Democrats decide, look, let's try to get something. Let's try to preserve it, maybe change it. There's a joke going around in Washington that the Republicans are going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with the Affordable Care Act.
It's all about the branding.
So.
Let me do this. We're talking obviously not only about branding, but really about the rescinding of federal protections for transgender students, to new immigration policies, to protests, to town halls. A lot having gone on this past week, and you may want to weigh in here. And in fact, we invite you to do so, not only with your thoughts and emotions, but also with questions or comments. I'll give you the toll-free number to call, and you can join us now whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Number to call, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Please join us at that number, 866-733-6786, because we do want to hear from you, want to hear any questions or comments you have. You can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website and post questions or comments there. It's kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And one thing that hasn't been getting a lot of attention but probably should is essentially we're talking about rescinding Affordable Care Act, rescinding reduction of federal prisons by Sessions. That is the number of private prisons that were under the Obama administration. And this is big. I mean, this is certainly a news story that really ought to be given a lot more attention because it means more privatization of prisons. And all these problems that were found in privatization of prisons are just going to continue.
Yeah, that had begun to scale down under Obama. And as you said, that got rescinded. And so, you know, it's unclear who is going to end up in these private prisons, but they don't have the same level of transparency or funding or accountability that public prisons and jails do. So a lot of people see it as kind of a dark box that is not necessarily the way to go. But as the president expands the pool of people who are eligible for deportation, you know, you have to wonder where are they going to go while they're awaiting any kind of procedure that would, you know, before they're sent out of the country again. And, you know, it's a real reversal because the, you know, for a long time under Obama, there was a real bipartisan consensus that criminal justice reform, we needed to do that, that the rules were disproportionately hurting minorities and drug offenses being disproportionately handed out. But that bipartisan consensus seems to be long gone.
Well, I'm also struck by, and Joe, let me go to you on this, the fact that we're coming up on a break here, but more people are being rounded up. As I said, ICE agents are calling, they have the right to do this. They call themselves police, and they're putting more people, as somebody said, on the bus, but they're not necessarily screening the way Trump has been suggesting they ought to be screened. In other words, getting people in numbers, but not necessarily the people those bad folks, those bad dudes that Trump keeps talking
right.
about.
Right. And the language coming out of the White House continues to be sort of the demonization of immigrants. He always talks about the bad dudes. He always talks about, but I'm only getting rid of the bad ones. But we've seen from the early reports that he's breaking up families. There was a story of a woman who was in an abusive relationship. She went to court and then she was taken away in court when her partner tipped off ICE that she was in the country without documentation. And so, I mean, that's the big fear of these roundups is you're going to have people being afraid to report crimes, being afraid to cooperate with authorities. It's
already,
unraveling,
I think,
right
probably
now.
Had an effect on police relations with those in undocumented and so forth.
Yeah.
We are coming up on a break. And as I said, when we return, we'll also return with your calls and emails. Feel free to join us. Again, you can do so. Email forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @kqedforum. While we're coming up on the break, tax cut predict? Anybody? Scott?
Yeah, we haven't even gotten to that. That's a huge expense. I think we're starting to see that as Dick Cheney realized, deficits don't really matter, Michael. Reagan proved that, right?
That's right.
It'll be huge.
They don't have those in the memorabilia with the GOP
no,
you alluded to
no,
before.
There were no graphs of the deficit.
When we return, we hear from you, our listeners. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about, well, from CPAC to a new leader for the DNC, all the political news, really, that's in the news, and an update with our own Scott Schaefer, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, who's here with us in studio, and Joe Garofoli, who's also here with us, senior political writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, and Shannon Pettypiece, who's with us from Washington, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. We're going to go right to your calls and emails. First, Shannon, I just have to ask you a quick question because we were talking about it a bit off air, and that is all this talk about leaks and sources and everything. Does anybody get the irony in the Trump base and the strong supporters about, you know, all the leaking that he did when he was, shall we say, before he was a politician, saying, for example, he had sources about Obama's not being born in the United States. He wouldn't name those sources, but all kinds of sources about who he was dating under different names. It turned out to be Trump making the phone calls. That's all been verified. I mean, is that going around Washington?
There was a good story in the New York Times that pointed out this irony and this way of, you know, just that Trump is used to being able to control the media like he did as a businessman in the tabloids. He was a very savvy at using the press in New York, you know, with all the New York tabloids and New York, you know, newspapers, you know, so, yeah, I think there's a bit of frustration there on the use of anonymous sources. It's certainly been the irony has been pointed out that many times White House officials will formally brief reporters or talk to reporters and say, OK, but I don't use my name. You know, it's only on background, meaning I can only be a person familiar or White House official or White House aide. So when, yes, Trump went after anonymous sources, yeah, everyone pretty much wondered if he either knew that many of his own officials were talking to reporters under that, or if he, you know, or maybe he just didn't care and it was a good soundbite.
John Miller and John Bannon, those were the names he used when he was in New York. Yeah. Joe, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, no, all the stuff about the media and Trump's interactions with the media, I'm very conflicted about that because personally and professionally, I think it's horrible some of the things that are going on. But politically, in the raw politics, he needs an enemy. He doesn't have an enemy now. There are no Democratic, virtually no Democratic opposition. You know, they can.
He needs an enemy, or the GOP needs an enemy.
He needs an enemy, and in writ large, the GOP needs an enemy, and this is a convenient enemy.
You know, Michael, there's an old story about JFK when he was in the White House, and there was a story in the media, the Washington Post, he didn't like, and he told Pierre Schlesinger, his press secretary, to get to the bottom of it. And he came back a couple days later and said, "Mr. President, I've figured out where the leak came from. It was you."
It was you, yeah.
Right. Yeah, you know, he had been talking to the Washington Post at some dinner party, and there you go.
And here we go to your calls. Let me go next, right away to Doyle. Doyle, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I was wanting to ask about Sean Spicer's comments last week that he predicted there would be a crackdown on states with recreational marijuana. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions, I know, is an outspoken opponent of marijuana in general. I was wondering what the panel's predictions on that were and wanted to ask how that is justified against the rhetoric of states' rights that we always hear from the GOP.
Yeah, Joe, you want to comment?
Yeah, that was something I was asking people about all weekend. And there is a major dichotomy because on one hand, you have transgender rights. The White House is saying, well, that's a states' rights rule. But on the other hand, they're saying, well, cannabis, no, that's, you know, it's in conflict with federal law. And this is something they're going to have to resolve. And a lot of the Republicans at the convention this weekend were saying they agree that they're hardcore. And this, again, these are the hardcore activists. It should be all about states' rights. I've wrote a story a couple weeks ago saying that the Trump administration is really not going to, you know, really care about the cannabis issues here. First of all, there's a ton of money to be made, and I think they're going to walk away from it.
Let me thank Doyle for the call. I want to go right to another caller here, and let's bring Celia in next. Celia, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I'm a teacher. I have trans students. I have trans family members. Based on his latest ruling, how am I supposed to alleviate their fears that they're going to get attacked? They literally talk to me all the time of, like, how am I supposed to protect myself out in the public?
Scott Schaefer.
Well, you know, and it's not just trans students. It's also DACA students, the Dreamers, you know, who are not a part of this immigration executive order that the president signed last week. But, you know, there many of folks live in mixed immigration status families. They're worried about their parents being deported or their siblings. Yeah, there's a lot of fear out there. It's hard to know what to say because you can't say categorically, look, we'll protect you. I mean, here in California, we are to a certain extent protected from, you know, things. You know, we have abortion rights here. That's not going to change no matter what happens to Roe v. Wade. But there's an atmosphere, a climate of fear and, you know, bigotry in some cases. We've seen what's happening with the Jewish cemeteries with tombstones being overturned. And whether or not you can lay that all at the, you know, the doorstep of Donald Trump, I don't know. But certainly it's caused a lot of anxiety in different communities, including the transgender community and their family members.
And let me go to more of your calls in a moment, but let me go to a tweet here, Shannon Pettypiece. I'd like to get your response to this. This is a listener named Emma who says, can we talk about emoluments clause violations? What can people do to bring this to the fore?
First, you have to spell it.
Yeah, or pronounce it. And I mean, this came up again on Saturday night. I was with I was in a van outside the Trump Tower Hotel being held, which is where they held the press pool when Trump went to his hotel, you know, to have dinner. His first Washington outing was down the street to the Trump Hotel in Washington, and people raising questions about that. The Kuwait embassy had a party there, you know, was it a few nights earlier? So it was another issue once again of, are they doing that to curry favor with the president? And, you know, I mean, I was just having lunch with a lobbyist who was saying, yeah, of course people want to stay at the hotel. You know, when you meet the president, you can say, oh, Mr. President, I was at your hotel this morning. So beautiful. You know, an icebreaker conversation piece. You know, it's might not get you what you want, but, you know, there is an issue. There's something there to be said that that hotel in particular is benefiting from all this. So anyway, to get to the bigger point, I mean, when people talk about the best ways to raise issues, over and over again, I hear this issue of, go to the town hall, call your senator, your senator or congressman or your representative, and keep these issues in front of them. And that, as I said, you know, there's going to have to be a decision made about, you know, whether you're with this president or not so much. And I think the more that members of Congress hear from constituents one way or another, whether they support something the president's doing or they don't, it seems like that is having an influence as they try and gauge the public opinion here and what's really, you know, kind of a volatile time in the country right now, as you guys were just talking about, with a lot of fears and concerns out there.
And let me go to more calls and remind you, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Here's Wynn. Wynn, you're on.
Thank you. With Russia being our new friend, and with us proving with three wars in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq that we don't know how to handle insurgency wars, with everything going on in the Middle East as being internal battles, and with huge overruns in some of the equipment that we bought for the military, that only leaves China. Are we preparing a war with China, or who are we going to fight?
Well, you know, this morning Trump was talking about his appointment, former Iowa governor, as China's ambassador, and he was saying, he kept telling me during my campaign, don't say so many bad things about China. So I appointed him because he likes China so much. And it was almost like a strange kind of olive branch, because during the campaign particularly, he was talking about, now he's also kind of mincing his words about trade. He's saying, it's not that I'm so much free market. I want fair trade. I want, you know, good nationalistic America first trade and so forth. So you see these kind of shifts going on all the time, don't you, Joe?
Yeah. And Steve Bannon over the weekend said that, the dissolution of the TPP, the massive trade deal that we were the United States was about to get involved in, the dissolution of that was one of the greatest moments in American history, because they want him to have one-on-one trade deals, which they can, if they don't like the terms of it, then they can get out of it. Because Trump is treating everything like the art of the deal. He makes the big opening offer, he punches you in the face, you back off, and then you know, resets the terms of the deal. And he's taking that ethos into politics, and it's unusual.
And, you know, we were talking a few minutes ago about all the sort of consternation and anxiety and in the transgender community and immigrant communities. Same thing's happening internationally. You know, we've seen spats with Mexico, Sweden, Paris,
Australia,
Canada to a certain
almost
extent.
Almost every one of our allies, our biggest allies.
Yeah, and I think, as Joe said, I think that his MO, in a way, as a business person, was to just keep everybody a little bit off stride, you know, and so they don't quite know what's coming. And he sees that as
a good negotiating
as a negotiating tactic. Yeah. But, you know, there are other implications when you're talking about world order.
Well, we mentioned Bannon featured on Saturday Night Live as Death itself or the Grim Reaper. And here's Michael, who writes, is Bannon's deconstruction of the administrative state concept the political philosophy that is driving this administration? This concept has been referenced as an explanation for the many cabinet appointees who expressed a desire to eliminate the departments they were chosen ahead. For example, energy, EPA and education departments.
Yes, he pointedly said we nominated deconstructionists. We think the federal bureaucracy, the taxes, the trade, the international agreements we have are bad. We want to reset things, and we're going to continue to fight to do that. And
but
that's
there's that infamous statement he made supposedly at a party about wanting to be like Lenin and bring the whole house down. But he uses language. He uses rhetoric, ideological rhetoric about the corporate estate and this sort of thing and bringing it down.
But he talks
economic
about,
nationalism.
Yeah. And the strange thing is that, you know, he talks about corporatists, but then all the cabinet heads are these people who made their money through corporate America. They're wealthy multimillionaires.
You remember the campaign, all those talks of Hillary Clinton's, my tax returns won't be exposed, but she should expose those speeches she gave to Goldman Sachs. How many people from Goldman Sachs do we have in this administration?
Several.
Yeah, I think four or five at least.
Well, you know, when we were talking about Daryl Issa.
Including Bannon.
Congressman from...
Yeah, Bannon was an executive there. Right.
You know, over the weekend, Daryl Issa was calling for a special prosecutor. And at this luncheon speech to the Republican Party, he was saying how we really need to make sure that this is the most transparent, accountable administration. And then afterwards, you know, I asked him, well, should then Trump release his taxes? Because how else are you going to know? Oh, no. No, that's not what I was talking about.
More of your calls. We go to San Jose. Rick, join us. You're on.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my question. I was wondering, based on the new Democratic leadership right now, I consider myself a moderate voter. I've been voting Democratic for a long time based on social views, but more of a fiscal conservative. I don't fit the stereotype. I mean, I'm a Christian. I own guns. I'm all of these types of things, and I feel there's a huge moderate electorate out there that's up for grabs that went to Mr. Trump this year. Wondering what the Democratic Party is considering doing in kind of reclaiming voters like myself who kind of are more pragmatic and really want to see the country move ahead, but at the same time aren't at the polar end of the spectrum.
It's a good question, an important one, and thank you for it. And Scott, I mean, the decision not to go with Ellison is definitely, I think, revealing of where the Democratic Party wants to go.
Yeah, Keith Ellison, who was came in close second for the DNC chair. Yeah, you know, I think that there's a lot of debate going on within the Democratic Party, and people look back at Hillary Clinton's campaign. She never went to Wisconsin. She didn't really go to Michigan to campaign, and there was a feeling that her message, "Stronger Together," really didn't speak to people like the caller, who have concerned economic anxieties, and so there's a big question, as there was, you know, when Bill Clinton sort of came on the scene in the early 90s, like, what is the party going to stand for? How is it going? Is it going to reach out to those voters, the ones who the so-called Trump Democrats, you know, in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin? Or are they going to go all in, as I think people who supported Keith Ellison felt, for the new demographic, the changing demographic? And it's a debate that's going to continue, clearly, with the election of Tom Perez as DNC chair. Like, where are they going to put their marbles? And I think it's important for the party, any party, you know, if you're going to win, if you're going to make progress, say, in the House, you got to nominate people who resonate with the voters in that district. And I think, you know, there are several Republican members of Congress in the Central Valley in particular who on paper look vulnerable. You know, Jeff Denham, David Valdeo, maybe Nunes. But the party has not nominated folks who resonate with, you know, Democrats, conservative Democrats in the Central Valley. And so I think we're going to see this play out in the coming, you know, 18 months.
And what are you seeing playing out in Washington, Shannon Pettypiece? I mean, particularly in terms of Democratic opposition under Schumer and the like?
Right. And trying to decide how are they going to pick their battles. So like the Supreme Court nominee Gorsuch, I think that will be a very interesting test of this. You know, do the Democrats decide to go all in and battle this one and, you know, risk the Senate, you know, Republican leadership pulling out the nuclear option? Do they, you know, instead say, OK, well, you know, he could be worse, you know, it's, you know, there's a lot of people they would like less in that position. So just go with this one. I think, yeah, they're going to have to pick some battles here on the Hill. On the Democrat level, though, you know, I was talking to someone a few days ago who said, you know, don't forget about the state House level, too, and what the Democrat Party could do down there, because as more things are going to get, you know, punted to the states, theoretically, with increase of states' rights and with gerrymandering and redistricting, there's a lot of influence that could be done at the state level. And we see big donors like the Koch brothers who've been focusing their resources at the state level for a while now. And
not putting any money behind Donald Trump, by the way.
Yeah. And so that's potentially an area we could see the Democrats focus on as
well. Let me focus on some comments here, because right in line with what we're talking about with the DNC, here's Paul who writes, the DNC will fail, flail, flounder, and fail. Its playbook, more divisive identity politics, more hate-mongering against Trump and his supporters, more coddling of illegals, and more corporate warmongering. So more comments coming in, particularly on the EPA. Here's a listener who tweets, it's sad to see the Department of Defense budget going up and the Environmental Protection Agency budget going down. A two-thirds staff reduction is ridiculous. And Tanner says a group of Bay Area residents met at the EPA regional office in San Francisco on Saturday for a rally in support of the EPA's crucial work. This morning, we're dropping off flowers and note cards for EPA employees. No matter what happens with Trump's budget, resist SF is there to support the EPA. We are not EPA employees, just concerned citizens. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go to Damian next. Damian, thanks for waiting.
Oh, thank you. My question is this. If the Democratic Party wanted to elect a charismatic person, why did they elect Perez? Who is this guy? He seems so uncharismatic. Well, Keith Ellison was a great fundraiser. I look forward to your answer. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Joe?
Well, I don't know if I can speak for the Democratic Party, but the caller is a great question, Damian, because what happens to all the energy that was the Bernie campaign? Because a lot of them sat in the sidelines, or were certainly, they may have voted for Secretary Clinton, but they were certainly not as enthusiastic on the road, on the street, as they were for Bernie. What happens to them? And then, so that's a question that the DNC is going to have to answer. And also, what do they stand for? You cannot just hate on Trump for another 4 years. It's obvious that did not work during the campaign. And so Perez is talking about, we have to lead with our values. So what are our values? And they need to focus on that.
They need some new ideas, I think, as well. They need some compelling. I don't think it's so important that the head of the DNC be charismatic, but they have to have some ideas.
What about reaching out to their traditional troops? I mean, reaching out more to labor. I mean, they've lost a lot. Like you said, they didn't go out to the Rust Belt to campaign. They have to find ways to make some progress in terms of support from labor and support from traditional Democratic support.
Yeah, I mean, labor is really back on its heels. I talked to a friend last week who works for the AFL-CIO in D.C. He was laying staff off. It wasn't entirely not because of this, but, you know, they are very vulnerable now. There was a case that went up to the Supreme Court last year having to do with public employee unions. The lower courts had ruled for the unions, and so it was deadlocked with Scalia gone. But, you know, with Gorsuch there, they could lose a big chunk of their money. And, you know, union membership has been on the decline for some time. So, you know, I think that reliance on labor it's still critically important to the Democratic Party. But, you know, they need to expand, I think, their horizons as well.
And we will expand our horizons with another caller from Virginia. Amy, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am... my husband and I are third-generation farmers in very rural Virginia, and last week ice came through and was literally scaring everyone to death. I spent the week comforting people. I'm just curious. I've known that, or we've been focused on the labor shortage in this country for 20 years. Where do they think the labor is going to come from for spring harvest, spring planting? Poultry, beef. I've heard some Republicans on TV start saying, whoa, we didn't mean farmers, immigrants. That is our total food source. People don't, if they would just drive through the fields and see what's going on. I've called representatives. I've called Kane. All they can do is sympathize. From a humane point of view, it's unbearable. But from a business side, we made it through 2007. If they take our labor, they're going to kill us.
I'm just curious, did you see any of these ICE agents in the past? Is this brand new?
It's brand new.
Yeah, they're much new. And Trump wants to hire a lot more of them.
They are stopping at the stores where the migrants come to get their food, and they're waiting for them.
I was talking to a woman just last week who works for a nonprofit Latino, serving the Latino community in the Mission. And she said ICE agents came in with bulletproof vests, big weapons. They have a preschool in the building. They were allegedly looking for some sex offender who they didn't find. But she said the same thing, that she'd never seen anything like that. So, You know, as this expansion of the pool of people who are eligible for deportation, I think you're going to see a lot of this kind of thing. And it's very troubling to people like the caller and like the woman I talked to.
Well, but the caller makes a point, too. And let me go to you, Shannon, on this, Shannon Pabies. I mean, the GOP should be concerned about the impact this is going to have on business. You're rounding up people who are really a labor force in terms of not only agriculture, but across the board.
Yes, I think I'm so glad this caller called in, because I think this is a really important point, just not about the labor force, but about the impact that some of these policies are going to have on rural America, which delivered this election to Trump, which has solidly backed Republicans, and not just this issue with immigration, which is going to hurt the labor force in rural America and a lot of these agricultural businesses, food processing businesses, but also things like TPP, which would have been hugely beneficial to rural communities, depending on agriculture and dairy and cattle and chicken processing plants and all that. So, you know, it's kind of this irony that this, you know, pro-business president who was such an advocate, you know, and was supported so widely in rural America has some of the first things he's done directly hurt rural America the hardest when it comes to trade and immigration and workforce issues. And so, yeah, I think the caller's point's really important. And I don't see it changing at this point. You know, they've said that the focus initially is going to be on immigrants with a criminal record, but there is no amnesty being talked about for others. There is no pathway to citizenship being talked about. There is nothing about, you know, temporary visas for agriculture workers being talked about at this point. So the indication is, yeah, it's going to start because you can't eliminate 11 million people or whatever the number is you want to agree on at once with folks with a criminal record. But if you get caught up in that and you're not supposed to be here, there is no, oh, okay, well, don't worry, we'll let you stay. It's just that the focus is on people with a criminal record. But there has been nothing about, you know, amnesty for everyone else or some sort of turn a blind eye to everyone else.
Yeah, and Joe Garofoli, yeah. You wanted to weigh in here?
Yeah. And Shannon, as she was alluding to, that immigration order is written so broadly that anyone who has crossed the border could be considered eligible for deportation. Two Californians could be key here. Kevin McCarthy, Devin Nunes. They both have Trump's ear. They're both friends of the White House, and they both represent very rural Central Valley districts. And they've talked to him. McCarthy's told me he's talked to him about some kind of deal where to keep the labor force there. Upwards of 70% of the people who are working in California's fields are believed to be undocumented. These are the people who actually picking the food that we eat from the breadbasket of the country here. So something has to be done, and those two could be on the front.
Well, in fact, the caller is from Virginia. I was thinking about Terry McAuliffe because he was at the governor's meeting this morning, and Trump actually singled him out and said nice things about him. It was interesting. Let me thank her for the call. I don't know what's going to happen in Virginia, but here's a Trump supporter who writes, I don't think that the shouting at town hall meetings by Hillary supporters will change the direction of our country. For those of us who quietly suffered through 8 years of a president who seemed to be out of touch with the vast territory between the left coast and New York State, this is a refreshing time. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Richard in Illinois. Richard, you're on.
Yes, KQED Forum. Thank you, gentlemen. Now, if Perez and Ellison, just like the other caller said, if they want my vote again, they really need to come and clean up. Just like the billionaires, they want cheap labor. If you come into in Northwest Chicago, where I live, right next to the black neighborhood, the reason they're killing each other, because you come in at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, you'll see all these illegal immigrants that stolen their jobs. And, of course, it's all a takeaway. Trump does the takeaway. Like, for example, I'm an immigrant. They want the Wahhabi Saudis to take over Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and all these countries. So we're playing all these political games, foreign games, just so the Saudis can come in and take over those lands and convert it. Just like there's 10 Muslim countries right now, they cleaned out all those liberals that wanted to coexist. And now you can't even find one national in these countries. The press that's paid by the Saudi money, they're not even mentioning anything about that, how they completely genocide the Jews, the Christians out of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Richard, you're hitting on a lot of things here. I'd like to just deconstruct a few of the things that you hit on initially. And one is Chicago, which President Trump actually singled out this morning once again, likes to use the word carnage about Chicago and how things have to be solved there. How they're going to be solved, we haven't heard from the Trump administration. But he mentions the Saudis. That hits a certain nerve. You know, you've got these countries that have been singled out in terms of not allowing any immigrants. Saudi Arabia, you know, produced more terrorists than any country, and Saudi Arabia's not on that list. And
including the 9/11.
Including 9/11, right. And there are those who suggest, well, where's Saudi Arabia? Where's Pakistan? Where are these countries? Afghanistan?
And Egypt.
Egypt, that really produced terrorists. And a lot of people say, there's Trump money in those countries. I mean, that's a little bit maybe too facile, but nevertheless, it continues to rise. Joe?
Yeah, and that's what they're going to have to fix if they come back with this fix in the immigration travel ban that's coming out this week, because that's a major discrepancy. The countries listed there, they weren't responsible for any of the terrorism, the international terrorism going on here.
Well, and for that matter, I think refugees have been responsible for zero of the of the terrorist incidents since 9/11 on U.S. soil.
But yet the term when he uses refugees is always sort of painted as kind of like international terrorists.
Yeah.
They're equated where they have to go through a 2-year vetting period.
Yeah.
And it's again, demonization of the other and creating an enemy where perhaps there is not one.
Well, we've got seconds left here. Anything new that should come up tomorrow that we should anticipate? Or?
Well, I'm going to be interested to see, is the President Trump actually going to issue any kind of an olive branch? Because really, since the election, there's been really nothing said or done.
He said he was going to unify, right? He wants
but there's really been nothing that he has said that has really done anything to reach across the aisle or reach across anybody who's disagreed with him on anything. And we'll see. Maybe a State of the Union address you'd think might be an opportunity to do that.
And it has to be beyond a campaign speech. He has to give some sort of substance here in terms of policy. I know it's not, he's not going to give a 10-point plan or whatever. But, I mean, this can't be another, rah-rah campaign speech, a reheated version of the thing he's been talking about for 18 months.
Shannon, seconds left. Let's hear from you on this.
I've been trying to tease out as many details as I can, and so far it just seems I'm just getting that it's this sort of vague things that he's been saying over and over again, like everyone needs health care, and so I don't know, maybe there's more details to come, but don't be surprised.
Well, we'll wait for those details and hope there's some lucidity and maybe some light coming through. Thank you, Shannon Pettypiece. Thank you, Scott Schaefer. Thank you, Joe Garofoli. And thank you, our listeners. We would not be here without you, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Hour ahead, we're going to talk about the Oscars. We've got the whole panel of film critics, and we want to hear from you about your thoughts about last night, including the big mix-up at the end. Stay tuned for that, and thank you for joining us for this hour and for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.